It's an honor to be here in an area that's really close and dear to my heart, and in beef cattle production and the purebred business, but all phases of production. And so today what I'm going to try and do is give you a little bit of an overview, give you some insight, give you some historical perspective, and then give you some information on technologies. There's been a change. And so some of the things that were holding this field up and stuff, we've had some things that maybe have made this a little more possible now. But we'll talk quite a bit about history and where the field has gone, where it's going, and kind of some basic stuff just about simple Mendelian genetics and how we can use simple marker tests sometimes to overcome some breeding problems when we have them. So it's a young and changing technology, and I started to make this slide, and I'm thinking to myself, is it really that young of a technology? I started graduate school in 97. This whole idea of genomics and markers had been around for 2 or 3 years. The technology was young and youthful at that time, and people were promising people the world, and so it's been around a long time, but I still say it's an extremely, extremely young technology, that we're still in a lot of the learning phases in that. And the great thing about what we've come to realization is in the early days when I was in graduate school, you would see groups around the country that were molecular people would argue with the quantitative people. And everybody was really off base in thinking about this that way. This is a tool to do genetic selection that complements what we know. We're now looking at analyses of the genome with a physical way of measuring it in addition to the quantitative tools that we used before. So it's not a one or the other proposition at this point. We need to always think about that. Especially we need to think about how this tool really affects the seed stock sector, and that's where if implementation is really going to work, where it'll first be. But the commercial cow-calf and finishing phase sectors, I think, really hold some promise. So oversold. This slide used to be at the end of my presentations. Now I've actually moved it to the front when I give a talk like this. We oversold this through the years, yes. That's what scientists do. They get all excited. They're trying to get funding. They're trying to leverage the industry for money, leverage the federal government to get grants. And we sometimes don't think about how hard it is to overcome these hurdles and can we really deliver. And that's exactly what happened and why the genome is very complex. We thought early on, science will oversimplify things to a point where we really start taking for granted that we really are just scratching the surface and we really don't understand completely what we're doing. If we did, science wouldn't exist. It's the great unknown and we constantly work there. Historically oversold to producers, yes. This was an example that my mentor and I made back in 1999 when we would give these industry talks about a little vision of what the future is. And we thought, you know, it wasn't that many years down the road that we would see panels of markers for marbling, and if each dot represented a test in the genome, that maybe that number of markers could account for 50 or 60% of the genetic variation. Well, we haven't gotten to that. That's almost a decade ago, and here we are looking at this same example, and we're not there. But there's been some changes, and we'll talk about that are leading us to maybe some of these panels that will allow us to get to that much of the genetic variation. So I talked to Sally on the phone, and I was putting together a list of a lot of the phenotypes that all of you collect that are used in your national cattle evaluation and for different things. And in some of with the Ames program, some traits that I think are extremely important that aren't collected on a regular basis that I think could have huge impacts in a genetic selection down the road, especially in the commercial setting. But we're getting fairly good at this. And phenomics is a field that people have liked to start talking about. But phenotypes, those are the key to everything you do as seed stock producers. The better you can measure a phenotype, the better all the science works. The better your national cattle evaluations will work, the more accurate you in the phenotype collection, and markers are no different. So what that phenotype is and how it's defined is extremely important for what happens with this genetic information and how we interpret it. And William did a great job of setting that up and talking about different environments and how animals perform in different phases of production due to management. All these things are critical, and we always need to be thinking about this. Genetic selection is much easier than it was 30 years ago because we have some really neat tools when EPDs came online in the mid-80s. But it's still something that we can do a lot better and always do much better, and it's These basic things are very key in doing that. So traditional selection works well. Wow, we've done a great job when you look at it. You know, frame score differences, selection for increased height gain, those kind of things, worked really well. You know, using these these set of tools over the last, say, 20 years, 30 years, and now coupling economic indexes, we start to look at, does modeling of certain traits and things that we don't have a lot of information, can that be incorporated? And DNA marker information, can it be incorporated and work with the traditional tools that we're using? Selection index, as we move forward, and if DNA technology becomes part of what you do every day and becomes part of your national cattle evaluations, it becomes part of selection index. Single trait selection, we all know, can get you in big trouble. We tend to jump on those things as producers sometime and use whatever's hot. And in the long haul, we have to think about indexes. We have to have indexes for different phases of the industry, and we have to constantly think about this, that every producer and index is not going to work the same due to what their end product is or the environment they work in. And we always constantly need to think about these as they evolve. So let's get back to some basics. Bill called me a couple weeks ago, and we were discussing a little bit about the talk, and we got to thinking about some of the things that all you all are going through right now from a genetics perspective, and a little bit just about basics of DNA and thinking about how do we deal with some of these things, like when we have an example, a birth defect pops up, and how do we manage it and manage it with genetic selection and a DNA test. And because of tools like DNA testing and stuff now, we have the ability to manage these things much better than 20 years ago, and that's really important. So DNA we can get from a whole series of samples. You're all probably most familiar with blood. The hair roots, we pull them from tail hair, the root where the actual cells are, but we can get it from a series of other things. We do a lot of collection of DNA from semen samples. So really simply, I mean, an animal's made up of lots of different tissues, muscle, fat, blood. All these things have cells, except for red blood cells. Everything has a nucleus in it. And it's in this nucleus that contains the genetic material, the nuclear DNA, where all the genes are located on chromosomes. And these chromosomes come in pairs. And you inherit one chromosome from your sire, one chromosome from your dam. And these chromosomes in a way kind of mirror each other, but not exactly. They will have at similar positions on them the same gene, but not the same copy of the gene. So when you hear people say alleles, a allele copy of this gene or an allele copy of this marker, they're referring to in cases where we have gene A, the same gene for on each chromosome, but there might be a mutation in gene A that actually is not, the position's not mutated in allele B, so allele 1 and allele 2 for gene A, and that makes it different. So that animal would be a heterozygote, where it has different copies of allele 1, allele 2, or if allele 1 and allele 1 were both the same, it's a homozygote. So if you kind of get that in your mind on this two chromosome idea and this idea that genes, you have two copies of the same gene, but they're not identically, usually the same copy, potentially. And they might be. So, and these are the DNA, when you look at a strand of a chromosome, they're made up of four bases that just repeat in all kinds of different combinations in that. And there's about 3.1 or 2 billion bases in the human genome. The bovine genome is very similar as far as total size, maybe just a little lesser. This is very similar. And they have this complementary thing between them. So it's a double-stranded kind of thing, but you're usually just, you're looking at these four bases and thinking about it, and we'll talk about SNPs a little later on. So thinking about like just simple Mendelian genetics, coat color makes a nice example to use to think about DNA inheritance. Coat color, horn pulled, couple things this breed hasn't had to think about a lot when they're doing genetic selection. And when we have a birth defect that shows up that is a simple, you want to call it a deleterious recessive, where it shows up when you have something show up in the top and bottom of a pedigree, this is the basic genetic model that is being used to think through this. And it's very simple. This is biology, kind of high school, sophomore year genetics. And this is how we teach genetics at even the high school level. Well, I learned it, first learned it. So if we think about, if black is dominant, which black is, and if we think about the animal at each chromosome being big B, big B, so it's homozygous for black coat color, and red is a recessive gene in this case. So you have to have two copies of the red allele, which is, so allele 1 being big B, big B, and allele 2 being little b, little b, to get red animals. And that's, if an animal's red, it's homozygous at that gene that causes a difference in coat color for the red allele. So what happens when we mate those two homozygotes, it's pretty simple. You get one strand of one chromosome from the sire that is the dominant black B allele, the B allele is transmitted. You get the little B allele from the red dam, and you get these heterozygous progeny. And it's when we start crossing up those heterozygous progeny that then we start getting this distribution of animals, that we start seeing about 25% are going to be homozygous for the big B, big B, 50% will be for big B, little B, and then you'll have 25% for little B, little B. So in the case of coat color, you'll have 25% of the calf crop's red, 75% of it's black with half of those animals that are black are actually 75% of the animals that are black are actually heterozygotes in this case, or 50% of the total calf crop. Birth defects in a lot of cages like TH, PHA, and a couple other breeds are inherited in this mode. And in DNA markers have allowed them to really to clean this up. So in the short term, the answer is to really watch your pedigrees. And just watch top and bottom matings and trying to avoid having that same family or individual represented in the top and bottom. If an animal's a carrier, it can pass on the allele, but as long as you're not mating it to another carrier, you're going to avoid the chance of getting the deleterious recessive effect. So if you manage it like that for the time being and just really watch some matings and be careful and watch what you're doing with top and bottoms of the pedigrees, as enough DNA becomes available and more pedigree information in those things, the molecular geneticist will get after it and develop a marker. And once you have a DNA marker, then you can manage it completely. And you can actually track animals that are carrier. And if you know you have a female that's a carrier and she's a superior producing female, you just have to test her progeny and then go from there. So it is very manageable. It'll just be time in the discovery of a DNA marker in that. So using DNA technologies, and this, when we start thinking about using DNA technologies, lowly heritable traits is where we might be able to get a lot done. This is the hardest area to do research in this area, just like even improving it from a genetic standpoint with EPDs. Reproduction, it's going to take huge data sets from all over the country, and to get enough information. But we can make some headway, potentially, with these lowly heritable traits, and reproduction would be a prime example of that. Sex-limited traits, being able to look at an individual and predict genetics without having to wait until the female went into production for milk can actually complement that, waiting for his daughters to get into production. Hard and expensive traits to measure like feed efficiency or some type of feed in energetic efficiency type related traits that we're never going to see massive amounts of data. We see more amounts, but could have a huge impact there. And here's the big one, and I think where the technology is really in. Accuracy and selection for the traits that we have, the traits we don't have. Can we increase accuracy of selection for a trait like birth weight? This is, and then we'll talk more about this as we move down the road. So there's two fields that have kind of evolved, and the bottom one is new, even in the last 3 or 4 years of us talking about it more and as we write our research plans and that. But marker-assisted selection, you've all probably heard for quite a while as people have sold and pumped this area a lot. And inherited diseases, coat color, all these things. And then we've seen some small panels of markers or individual tests addressing some of these quantitative traits. And some of them have done an okay job. Some of them don't. Some of them do. You know, how do we incorporate it into our program? Is it worth it? Should I use it? Should I not use it? All of that. But this is the area that really intrigues me from a commercialization standpoint of this, is marker-assisted management. Can we develop a suite of markers that can be used as a tool to sort like at the feedlot level? That give an advantage in profit with a branded program by targeting animals and managing them a certain way because they have a higher propensity to marble, and the DNA has showed us that with pedigree and everything else, that we manage them different. In a set of animals that aren't going to have a propensity to marble due to their genetics, we can manage them a certain way and not pump extra feed, and at this day with dollars costs actually make that work. And even at the cow calf commercial level and making some management decisions on females or how I'm going to sort cattle and move forward, this area of marker assisted management is very intriguing. And if the technology really takes hold and becomes part of everything in the seed stock, I think you'll see if we can make it profitable. Everything is always around cost. Exist in the commercial application. So here's a minor success story, and this is to the point, and William talked about how when they've done a cost analysis. This is a series of carcass traits. Research, this was the literature this spring when I wrote a review paper. These are QTL that have been found across a whole series of different research things worldwide. QTL are quantitative trait loci. That means that in the genome, they have found with some markers a region where there must be a gene with a polymorphism, potentially, that is having an effect on a trait or multiple genes in that region. So when people say QTL, that's what they're referring to. So if you look, basically, the whole these are chromosome, represent chromosome numbers, 1, 2, and it goes out to the beef cow or bovine have 29 chromosomes. We've found regions all across the genome affecting carcass traits. Well, we shouldn't be surprised. Quantitative genetics, and if we want to talk about an infinitesimal model where there's literally thousands of genes affecting a given trait, we shouldn't be surprised by this. So there's minor success there. We got good at doing QTL mapping and finding these peaks. The problem is there's only been small success in narrowing in on a marker that could actually be used commercially. And this is probably the biggest success date to date with the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center was the mucalpain marker combination that's used in that front polymorphisms in that gene that allow us to select for tenderness. This coupled with the calpostatin polymorphism is the tenderness test that you've seen on the market. And actually, the tenderness markers have done very well as far as validating for different companies and actually explaining a fair portion of the genetic variation. I think it gets upwards, and the claims are in that 15-20% of the variation for tenderness. So it's been one of the greater success stories, but there's been a lot of money spent trying to fine map these regions, and we have very little to show for it at this point as an industry as a whole. But things that have worked, and the associations have made switches to parental verification using DNA. This is a success story. I think one of the things that the technology drives this is the technology is changing to where this is becoming should become much cheaper down the road. Then we start talking about marker-assisted management with simple parental verification. Multi-sire pastures in the commercial setting where I'm a commercial producer, and if it's economically fits my structure of profitability, I could turn a terminal bull into a pasture of females and a bull that I've bought specifically to raise replacements out of. Parental ID by DNA on the sires, DNA on the progeny. I can retain the heifers I want to keep with my other selection criteria that are out of that sire I've bought for the maternal, but not keep some of them that I've kept for terminal, taking the chance that if we're buying for terminal, average daily gain, increased mature size, things that I wouldn't want to add more of to my cow herd. So that gets kind of intriguing. If we start talking about a test that's, you know, is $5 a head for parental ID, would somebody do, you know, 2,000 head at that? It's a deal of profit structure and where they can recoup costs and make it make money. But a lot of times when we talk to commercial producers about these technologies, they throw these $5, $10, $12 a test kind of numbers out. And when I say a test, not a single SNP for some package like parental ID. That might be 96 markers, SNPs, that are used to do that at like $5 to $10 a head. And that's where the technology has been changing here over the last year. Another obvious one is you've seen it done with archiving tissues for youth identification shows, on kind of a traceback kind of thing, putting that stuff away. Makes sense. Tracing products, this area you could see growing quite a bit. There are programs out there. For me, if I was in the purebred business right now managing Sullivan Limousine, I'd probably be archiving a tissue on every animal born on the place and throwing it and having a freezer and a way of setting up and doing that. Short-term costs are a little bit. Long-term benefits with the changing technology could be good, but I like science and technology, and that's would drive part of that decision. So if we think about this and we think about the beef business, I like to think about it as a pyramid. And I like to think about, you know, here the seed stock sector, even though we're a lot of people and a lot of ranches and organizations and farmers raising these cattle that this, you know, flow down to the commercial sector and that, we're still talking a small portion of the industry. And this is where marker-assisted selection, genetic improvement has its greatest impact. You know, when you think about it, our EPDs and national cattle evaluation are driven on what we do with the progeny of the sires that we use here, and then we sell them to the commercial industry, and then that's pretty much where we end. And there is some potential down the road with, if cost-effective in that, we might be able to capture more of that phenotypic information if we can sort out some of the breed stuff and the way those animals are crossed up, and with DNA information, actually bring some of that information back into our national cattle evaluations and expand our databases and make our tools much better. But the commercial cow cuff and finishing phases are much larger, and as we think about this marker-assisted management, I like to keep getting everybody thinking about the potential of that down the road. So tools for selection. You know, we've done growth well. Feed efficiency, we got to be more efficient. What the definition of this really is really, really tough. And I've got a whole series of talks that go into that. William did a great job. There is no golden bullet, and we all need to realize that. And one type of measure of efficiency is maybe not necessarily going to work for cow energy efficiency versus feedlot efficiency, animal feeding in the feedlot for energy conversion. And we need to be aware of that. We're doing research at Mark to try and look at these kind of things and make sure that look at the different phases of production, but understand overall production efficiency, whatever the segment and sector is. And so it's not a one thing fits all, and that's going to be the biggest thing we need to realize with all of this, is we need to, before we everybody dive in on a certain way a trade is defined, we need to make sure we understand what we're actually using and what we're doing with it. And be careful. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, and I've looked at some of our data and plotted it. Some of the most best residual feed intake animals are, on a daily dry matter consumption basis, the best ones consume way less than everybody else. But if we put it on a performance basis, maybe one of those makes the average for average daily gain, and we start looking at how would we fit that into an index. And we need to make sure that if we use something like RFI and think about, you know, the growing phase with yearling bulls and the finishing phase with steers, that we make sure we put that into an index. Because if we start selecting on animals that are going through the finishing phase, so to say, and using RFI numbers, and we're depressing appetite, and most of the data sets I've looked at, it's part of that RFI, this unknown, is appetite. I'm not sure we want to limit appetite on cows in certain production settings. Her ability to go out and forage and cover a lot of acres gets extremely important. And if she has a limitation in appetite, suddenly she's not putting on enough fat and enough energy conversion to actually raise a calf and get pregnant. And these are things we need to really, really think about. Will markers replace traditional selection? Right now, no. And I have a hard time seeing that when somebody gets up and says that with these new technologies that will happen, I don't think so. But the technology's changed, and this was a big part of it that happened with the sequencing of the bovine genome. It was completed 2 or 3 years ago. The initial completion reassembly keeps happening, but we now have this unique tool. So genotyping has gotten more focused on these single nucleotide polymorphisms, and if we look at our one chromosome strand of DNA and the other, you've had this change from a C has changed to a T, mutated along the way, and basically that looks like when you look at sequence, if this is the T and this is the C, a heterozygous animal gives you this lower peak right here, and so you have this polymorphism that we can use for genetic selection. And that's what's driving the new technologies at this point. And this is the big one. I've been part of a consortium with BARC, which is the USDA in Beltsville, Clay Center, the University of Missouri, and the University of Alberta, that myself and another scientist at Clay Center have been involved in. And we were able to help bring a commercial product forward where we can genotype 54,008 of these SNPs in a given assay in one animal. So we're talking before where you were maybe going to buy a DNA test that was, you know, three SNPs for two locusts for $25. And it was always the rate limiting factor when we did these mapping studies was the number of markers for the cost we can do the research. So now for $100 to $200, we've been running every animal with 54,000 markers. The animals I've been looking at for feed efficiency, the data set has 160 million SNP markers in it. And you start thinking of the power. The genome coverage has nice spacing. This was set up with taking multiple breeds into consideration with a little bit of emphasis in Angus and Holstein, but we had another five of the predominant breeds in the U.S. that were added in the discovery process, along with there's a large portion of the SNPs, 15,000 or so, that came right out of the sequencing project from the from that. So this is a product that kind of changes things. So that you hear this thing of whole genome selection. And so this is kind of that some are talking about like QTL research back in the mid-90s. This is a quote I get from Dorian Garrett, good friend of mine, colleague at Iowa State. But he's, you know, there's no doubt that whole genome enabled selection has the potential, let's all remember potential is a key word, for being the most revolutionary technology since artificial insemination and performance-based index selection to change the nature of livestock improvement for the foreseeable future. People that are quantitative geneticists that have been kind of in and out of this area of do we incorporate, how do we incorporate, are suddenly thinking that this holds some real promise and is pretty exciting. And it's because of this technology breakthrough that allows us to do this. So how does whole genome selection work for you if you were going to do it as a purebred breeder? Well, we're using a large panel of markers to estimate the genetic merit, so like this marker breeding value of an animal. So we use this marker information from across the whole genome to estimate the sum of effects. So in essence, we're taking like 5,000 different regions from the genome and adding all the effects together. And we're not so worried about, well, if I select for this marker in this region, this allele, but it's this one in another. We just completely, you kind of put that off. So counting stars and those kind of things is not even doable with this. It actually starts making us use it more like an EPD. So you use foundation information that is a population where these equations are derived with the associations to come up with this equation that allows you to plug in all this marker information from your animal and estimate the actual genetic merit. And this information could be coupled to EPDs. It can also be used to actually, if you could explain all of the additive genetic merit, you could use it as an EPD. So those traits that we can't really measure in stuff, this really holds a lot of promise when we start thinking about reproduction and that. And we can add it to the traits we do measure. So this is an example of daily dry matter intake, 50-some thousand markers. This is an association analysis across. But what we see is we get these regions that pass these thresholds that we think are maybe real regions if we were going to chase just individual markers. Well, these probably only explain like 15 to 20% maybe of the genetic variation. It's all this signal under here that some of it's real and some of it's not that is helping us explain all of it. But we can't just start, there's no way to work through all that. We're talking millions and millions of dollars and hours and resources. And that's where whole genome selection starts showing more promise when we can look at these kind of numbers. So part of DNA and management of DNA resources is this information has to be, when it's generated, released to the breed associations so it can be used in national cattle evaluation. And the NBEC, National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium, and those involved with Beef Improvement Federation, everybody, are looking at ways of getting some of these early things into our way we calculate EPDs and add accuracy to the EPDs we do on very young animals. And that's those little baby steps are in the process, but it's really important. We need all the data that's being generated so we can actually estimate genetic effects for a breed that we can get some handle on it. So selective reporting really doesn't do any good, especially the way the technology is going. You know, genotyping 50 animals and then not sending in the ones that you think are giving you the genotype, maybe the recessive, the two alleles that are the lower or no effect for the genotype or negative effect for the genotype and the others, really doesn't do a lot of good because these allele frequencies segregating a population are real critical in estimating the genetic effects and understanding in our breed what is the frequency of that, the polymorphism that's segregating near that, you know, for that gene that we're marking that gene with. And that's extremely important. Can we make improvement or not with that? So in this field, the players have been evolving. And so I started this list back when I was in grad school in the late 90s and up until about 5 years ago. And I just kind of keep adding to it. And some of them are here, some of them are gone, some of them emerge. But what's happened in the last few years is you've seen some big companies step up and start putting quite a bit of investment in that. And then actually competition is good and drives technology in that. But you know, they're feeling like this really holds some promise. And some of that is very encouraging to me as a scientist. It should be exciting for all you because, you know, developing solutions and ways to enhance what you do with genetic prediction is pretty exciting. So the use of DNA in selection programs, and this kind of reiterates what we said, but gets back to these single marker tests, which we all are learning, you know, that we really don't need to think a lot about from a quantitative standpoint. But just because an animal is not segregating the good allele, the positive allele for net genetic effect, is no reason that we need to say, well, that animal's not having a positive effect for that trait. When you have a bull that has an accuracy of 0.95 for marbling, it doesn't. If we start looking at a handful of marbling markers and he's not segregating the positive alleles for genetic effects, he's got a whole bunch of other genes that are, because his progeny have proven with his EPDs, with that high of an accuracy, he's progeny proven tested. markers basically are doing the same thing. So if you have a broad enough panel of markers that explains enough of the variation for marbling, and you do that on a young animal, and that's incorporated into national cattle evaluation, however we fit that into the model, this value, you suddenly can account for this, like say 60% of its the animal's genetic variation for marbling. Suddenly you've helped with this young, unprogeny tested sire, you've helped move his accuracy, his direction of his EPD, and increase that accuracy to say like 0.6. And suddenly you're dealing with young animals with higher accuracies, taking some of the risk out. And that's real beauty. And they're doing this with whole genome selection already in dairy cattle, improved structure of the industry and the way they progeny and test, and that really lended an advantage to them. But it gives everybody some hope that whole genome selection really might work. So implementation into the industry, we got to have this information incorporated into our national genetic evaluation systems in the way that we run them now for the traits that we have. This information needs to become part of that. This needs to become part of the routine as we move along. And you have a wonderful group and staff that is always thinking ahead. Database development and structure. When I start talking, you start talking about 160 million genotypes. That's on like 2,000 animals, you know. So there's these things to overcome, but the technology and computers and that, we can build these databases to do these things and these models and that. We're involved in a project right now. We're partnering with the industry called the 2000 Industry Sire Project. It's basically the 16 breeds that have national cattle evaluations that wanted to participate. We have been running these chips on a pretty broad swath of what represents the genetics in each of those breeds to help develop this tool, to help facilitate and explore this whole genome selection as a tool to help move this stuff along. It holds a lot of promise. We can also validate with some of the bigger breeds, high accuracy growth bulls with their, and look at from our training data sets in a population that has connection to the industry, which is cycle 7. We used 150 some sires from the industry for 7 breeds. We mated them to Mark females. They were Hereford Angus and Mark 3s, created a bunch of F1 parents. We interse mated the F1, F1 matings, created 2, 3, and 4-way crosses, and these have massive phenotypes. The steers have individual feed intakes, tenderness. There's some sensory panel data, lots of growth data. Females are still in the herd and will be, and we're doing mature cow maintenance studies on individual feed intakes, along with most of them had individual feed intakes done on them. We can go through and do discovery in this and generate these equations. Then we can come back, like with the growth traits, and to validate this, we can come back with the growth traits, the connectivity of the industry, and say, okay, we have some Angus bulls with extremely high accuracies for growth. When we use the equations that we derived out of here, how well did the markers, when we look at that for birth weight, get us to the EPDs with the accuracies that they have to validate this process? And it's a huge tool for the industry in understanding this and moving forward, and the breeds have been wonderful cooperators in this, and it holds a lot of promise, and we're moving forward. All the previous bulls that we've used in cycle 7 and cycle 8 are also added to that, and there's been a huge portion of Miles City bulls in that, so we're building a nice database foundation across a lot of breeds and to move this forward. So present and future, as we move kind of to the end of this discussion and talk about some things, will DNA testing play a role in the future of the beef cattle business? Well, yes, and it is. With parental ID, these marker panels, I see in the short term these panels expanding, maybe not to using whole genome selection in a really short period of time, because we're just learning how to crawl with this. This is new for all of us. Every time we start looking at data and thinking about whole genome selection worldwide, we start coming with questions that we can't answer, that we've got to answer before this becomes a practice technology. But in the meantime, that 50K allows us to put together sub-panels and marker development, that suddenly there's going to be panels on the market that are explaining a greater amount of the variation. So these are a perfect time for those sub-panels to get validated and be used in populations and get incorporated into national cattle evaluation, and we start learning how to do this for everybody. And from the standpoint of inherited genetic diseases and that, the DNA tools are just are phenomenal, and that's been shown over and over here in recent history. Will implementation be tough? And maybe, and I say yes, I say let's all think back to the mid-80s when EPDs were implemented and the roller coaster ride we went on every time they did a sire evaluation. A lot of that's stabilized. Databases get bigger, and it's great how statistics work, and things are much more prediction. But when I was a youngster and in college and that, every time that ran and you'd start looking at a bull that you thought was really important in your program and that, and boy, all his daughters came into production, and he went from a +6 to a -24 for milk, and it just about killed you. And I mean, those things happen, but the bigger the databases are, the more they've stabilized, and EPDs work, and we've all accepted that, and it's become a huge part of genetic evaluation. But it wasn't always just really, really easy, and ultrasound was the same way. It took developing standards and developing an industry effort to just kind of get that really moving, and it's a wonderful, great technology. Collect tissues for DNA analysis and populations with phenotypes, and I can't emphasize this enough. Phenotypes are gold. They are what makes genetic analysis work, and really understanding that the better you collect those phenotypes, the more accurate you report that information, the better it is for not just DNA, but for national cattle evaluation as a whole. Breed associations' responsibilities are like they have been. The databases, guidance with phenotypes and models, and education. Working with people in the industry, the educators in that, and education, and like what you're all doing today, is wonderful, and these kind of things have to continue. Build the database structure and keep working with the experimental technology. It's not the end-all, save-all. It's not the pie in the sky. I always refer to it as another valuable tool in the animal breeder's toolbox. And maybe even another tool in the management of livestock and how we sort livestock when we think about marker-assisted management. So vision, these larger panels of markers are what we'll probably see over the next 24 months coming out. For some of the traits that we already have, some small panels of markers. And maybe for a few traits that we don't have panels of marker, it's a result of the 50K chip. We'll have genotyped, I'll finish in the next 30 or 40 days, we're getting upwards close to 6,000 animals right now in that. There's other groups that have done 15 to 20,000 animals across not just beef cattle, but also from the Holstein industry side of it. There's a lot of animals being genotyped experimentally worldwide with this tool with a lot of phenotypes, and that's good for the whole business as a whole. Whole genome selection, the question mark, will it be there? Yeah, maybe. And we're in the learning phases of that. It holds great promise, but there's a lot of validation, implementation, structure. Beef is going to be a lot more difficult than dairy cattle just because of the structure of our industry. And when you think about it, and the amount of progeny that we generate per sire and all these kind of things, that makes this part of it even a little bit higher. But the thing is to need to think about, could I have a yearling bull in my bull sale with information doing whole genome selection if this process is being incorporated? It has a birth weight EPD of 1.2 with an accuracy of 0.75 at 12 months of age. And that's on growth traits. And you start thinking about what does that do to the people that you sell commercial bulls to and that. Just on growth traits. We know we can select for growth traits and do things really well, but this gets to be, in my mind, kind of a fun impact, you know, and all the other things we can add to this. The big thing that drives this is change in costs. We've had this big turn in technology in the last 3 years with a couple different platforms out there that we're doing 54,000 markers for somewhere between $100 to $200 per animal based on the commercial rate and some of the scientific rates and stuff that are out there. That's incredible when you think about it. And some of the other platforms, we're down to like 3 and 2 cents in SNP where we're running like 45 of them in an assay at a time. Now there's DNA extraction costs and technician costs to do that. But we keep making these hurdles in the science and the technology. And that's not going to quit. We have sequencing technology now that probably would allow us to do the whole bovine genome for probably $2 to $5 million max, and probably do it better than we did with $53 million. And that's just all evolved in the last couple of years. They talk about this $1,000 genome, that it could be within a decade or 15 years. Well, we'll have to wait and see. That's a pretty big jump in technology, where we could sequence the whole genome of a given animal and line it up for $1,000. And that's kind of the pie in the sky, so you don't have to worry about that now. But technologies move and continue to happen in innovation. And with that, I'll be real happy to take any questions if we have time. I got a little time, a minute or two. But.
Mark, in the process of doing this whole genome work, have you looked at mitochondrial DNA and how that might fit into the whole system?
So I think about this quite a bit because I've got a younger brother that raises a lot of cub calves and uses clone bulls, and he brought up the point that when you think about clones and people start saying that they're getting progeny out of a clone to the progenitor that are better than the progeny they originally produced, that there's a difference. Well, that's impossible because the nuclear genome's the same, and on the male side, you're not passing mitochondrial DNA on, which means we probably know how to better mate that clone to the right kind of cow, and we get a better calf crop because we're more educated in how we do our matings, is probably what the difference is that people see. Now, on the female side, the mitochondrial genome is intriguing to think about. So you have this little cell, in your cell, you have this little unit that makes energy, and it's called the mitochondria, and it's involved in your whole energy metabolism and all that, but it's got this little circular genome of DNA. And there's genes in that little circular DNA that actually have, coupled with other products produced by the nuclear genome, that are involved in energy production. The basis of the energy is ATP that's produced by the body. So these little energy factories, so to say, that interact with your cell metabolism and are a big part of it. So if you have polymorphisms in the mitochondrial genome, we do know that there are some maternally inherited, and you inherit your mother's mitochondrial DNA. So your mitochondrial DNA is that of your mother, which is that of her mother, and so on and so forth. And they do a lot of lineage tracebacks to look at phylogenetic population patterns based on mitochondrial DNA. In livestock, there have been like really mixed results with quantitative geneticists of set up populations to try and show that you could show mitochondrial effects. And so a lot of the literature has been able to not show any effects of the mitochondrial genome when they've set up the experiments to do that. And other ones have said, well, they think they might be pulling them out. So it's kind of out in that regard on that. So when you have a cloned female, for example, a big part of her mitochondrial genome is that of the egg that was retrieved from the slaughterhouse and the nucleus was plucked out of. And then some of it is the cell that you fused with that egg from the progenitor, so you have this mix of mitochondrial genomes. You know, that could be tested real easily if we could produce some unreal amount of related clones and do some really neat experiments, but it's not cost-effective to ever try and do that. So there's potentially a difference there, but we really don't know. You know, on the maternal side. The male side, when you go through gametogenesis and sperm is made, the mitochondrial DNA is there's such a small content in that sperm, it's almost impossible to find it in the progeny cells. And that's why you're not seeing any of the mitochondrial DNA from clone sires being passed on. And so it is the sire versus the clone, the two of them are sending the same nuclear DNA on, which is exciting in that regard. And that's why clones that don't look like they're necessarily like the progenitor are because of things that happen in the cloning project when they go through making the clone and like the IVF kind of things, that all gets reset and reprogrammed when that individual starts making sperm. So a clone that looks nothing like his progenitor still is going to produce like his progenitor. And at least they have yet scientifically to show anything different. But kind of a long answer to that, but there's a lot of science in that one.
Chad, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was going to.
More questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.